94.5 WELY, it's the end of the road radio. I'm Brett Ross with our weekly wilderness update, brought to you by the BWCAW Coalition, funded by Lake County and St. Louis County. And I am joined today by Jeff Forrester. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Brett. My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you here. If you could just real quickly kind of give your background and your connection to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness.
You bet. My family is, they were Cornish tin miners that helped open the mines and tower. And then my family remained in the area. When I was in grad school at University of Oregon, I got a job working for the Wilderness Research Foundation out on Muckluck Bay.
Okay.
And they provided a grant for me to write Forest for the Trees, How Humans Shaped the North Woods, which is kind of the ecological history of the Boundary Waters area, northeastern Minnesota in general.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's a fascinating documentation of how I've spoken with a lot of people about this, especially this year as traffic has increased into the Boundary Waters, and people talk about a pristine wilderness area. And there's a bit of a myth in that term. I think a lot of people experience it that way, having never experienced something of this magnitude. But it really has come to be the forest and the wilderness that it is through centuries of human intervention.
Oh, absolutely. When I started writing the book, I believed, the big white pines we saw, my parents, that's virgin pine, it's mm-hmm. never been cut. And I had this idea of the Boundary Waters as wilderness. And what I discovered during the research was that it's been significantly impacted, that, the native, the tribal people that lived there going back to right after the Ice Age managed it with fire. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the resources that were there in northern Minnesota when my ancestors arrived, it was a cultural artifact, not necessarily a wilderness. It was managed. And of course, first thing they did was clear the white pine. And then in a sort of a patriotic effort, Arbor Day effort, they imported white pine seedlings from Germany. And the first invasive species was brought into the area, and that was the white pine blister rust, which we're still trying to manage and really, has almost 100% mortality. So if you look at the trees of the Boundary Waters, they're either under about 60 years of age, which is really when the blister rust kind of overcomes the trees.
Okay.
Or they're older, and they were seedlings or small trees when the logging took place and okay. were strong enough to survive it. Another thing I realized or learned when I was writing it was that the Boundary Waters area was dominated by moose, elk, and caribou.
Wow.
Reading, the menus from the logging camps, and they were serving moose, elk, and caribou. The deer are an invasive species that came in as the land was opened up by mining, and the habitat changed, and now, of course, we're dealing with, a different kind of invasive species, the aquatic invasive species mm-hmm. that we're working to keep out of the Boundary Waters. So it's kind of been the story of unintended consequence and sort of this changing, bringing new species in and that kind of permanently changing the forest type. I mean, with the deer, it gets very hard to manage for cedar trees. A lot of the undergrowth is changed by deer browse and white pine. They love white pine seedlings. So, you plant white pine seedlings and the deer will nip the top off.
Yeah, you see some great efforts by people attempting to bring back white pines, and you actually have to go and cap them all. You have to basically staple pieces of paper
right.
to the top of them to keep the deer from eating them.
Right.
So it's
right.
a big effort.
I mean, we have family land that we bought from my parents out on Pine Island on Lake Vermilion. And one day I was walking through the woods, and I see this little cedar tree sticking up. It's about 3 inches tall. And I go, oh, look at that. And I dug down, and there was like a 16-inch softball-sized root mass below it
wow.
with about 200 little nodes sticking up. So this 2-inch-tall tree was probably like 200 years old, and the deer just came by and nipped off that runner every year. And
oh, wow.
next year it sent up another one, but it was
It kept trying.
Old growth cedars. Yeah, it kept trying.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So they, you know, they really kind of end regeneration of cedar. And you know, if you look along the shorelines where cedar trees grow, you can see that sort of line off the water. Like it looks like the shorelines have a line along them on a lot of the lakes, and that's right. The deer browse from wintertime. You know, they get out on the ice and eat everything they can up as high as their necks will reach, and it creates this line of vegetation all around the shoreline. And it didn't exist before we cleared the white pine.
Wow.
And kind of rolled the ecosystem over to, I mean, so I'm sitting here as I'm talking to you, looking out at the Olympic Peninsula, which is known for old, you know, huge Doug fir trees,
sure.
6, 8, 10 feet in diameter. According to the surveyor records, the timber cruisers, there was more board feet of wood from Duluth North in the Arrowhead region than there was in the Olympic Peninsula.
That's amazing.
Right. The first surveyors rode horses up to Ely and through the woods up there. Imagine a glade, right, open between the trees. The trees large and spaced, you know, the white pine stands, with grasses growing underneath. And then every, you know, Bud Heintzelman found that, you know, fire passed over any given square inch of the boundary waters once every 30 years, mm-hmm. pre-settlement. So all the fir and kind of the brush was cleared out, and the lower branches were taken from the pines. So they, you know, they survived these low intensity fires and grew up. Well, then we began, you know, fire suppression efforts and, you know, kind of took the big trees out and created the conditions for fire. And, you know, anybody who's been camping, if you have a big round log and you throw it on your fire, the fire goes out. If you take small sticks and throw it on the fire, it flares up, gets hotter. And basically, we've got forests of small sticks now.
Right.
Yeah. So it's interesting because the, you know, we think about wilderness and maybe we're talking more about the way we feel when we're outside. But in terms of wilderness, you know, I don't know that northeastern Minnesota has ever been a wilderness. I think as soon as the ice retreated, there were people there. And they were managing it for their own benefit based on how their society was structured. And we've done the same.
So can you talk a little bit more about the history of the Native Americans on this land and what their specific aims were? Like you mentioned that they used fire to kind of manage the forest. What were the specific aims of that?
Well, so blueberries, for starters, like American sure. Point was burned more frequently, areas with a lot of blueberries. So they would send low-intensity fires through for blueberries. And then obviously for travel, if it's sort of an open glade, it's a lot easier to move around, control the bugs, create graves for their the species that they were, you know, hunting. So when you think about that, they were, you know, managing these herds of elk and caribou and moose, using fire as their main tool to create the browse that those species wanted. So it's kind of like farming without fences, you know? I mean, they were actively engaged in increasing the yield of the species that they were interested in on the land. It wasn't just this steady state ecosystem in balance with itself and the Native Americans just living off the fat of the land. They were creating the fat.
Right.
And, you know, we showed up and, you know, the estimates are really horrifying, but, you know, as high as 90%, 9 out of 10 indigenous people died from infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just, you know, the Europeans moved onto this continent and we didn't see a whole lot of people and there was this amazing abundance. And I've often wondered if it wasn't sort of rebound populations of animals once the hunting pressure was removed.
Sure, sure.
You know, I mean, there were more people living in North America when Columbus landed in Hispaniola than lived in Europe at the same time.
That's hard to believe.
So there were a lot of people here. You know, and then they died. And then these, you know, these populations of birds and buffalo and you know, elk and moose and caribou sort of rebounded, I think. And we just had this incredible bounty for a period of time based on their management of the land, their husbandry, mm-hmm. I guess would be the word.
And so we fast forward today with the current management through the Forest Service and Departments of Natural Resource. Do you foresee a rebound at some point of the larger ungulates? You know, we've seen the moose population struggle. Elk exist in a very tiny part of Minnesota right now. Same with caribou, an incredibly isolated area. Do you see with the current practices that those can ever make a rebound?
No, I don't think so. You know, and now, you know, based on the science of, you know, researchers like Lee Frelick down at the University of Minnesota and Peter Reich, who's up at the Wilderness Research Foundation, we're looking at a landscape of hardwood and oak savanna in the boundary waters within, you know, 100 years. So I think it's, you know, I mean, it's kind of ironic that we've been managing so intensively for aspen.
Mm-hmm.
Since that's a species that's kind of boreal in nature, and as it gets warmer, that species is going to retreat north. So, you know, for the last 100 years, we've been managing for a species that's not going to be here in the future. And, you know, as I walk, you know, we went up into the boundary waters a couple of years ago, and I found oak trees
mm-hmm.
off the portages, little oak trees growing, and, you know, stuff I'm seeing in the woods now that I never saw when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's always strange to come upon an oak tree in the woods around here, for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, on some places you see hundreds of it, you know, if the conditions are right and, you know, something gets started. So I think that the deer might be there to stay. Maybe they'll get better tasting after they start eating a lot of acorns.
Right, right.
You know?
Got to find some benefits in it.
I'm not sure about moose, elk, and caribou returning.
Yeah, it seems like it would require a big departure in the current management of the forest
right.
and allowing fire to take its course, which, as we see, that's more and more rare. We do see the occasional controlled burn, but if they wanted to really manage the forest through controlled burns, it's virtually impossible at this point.
Yeah, it would be very, very difficult, you know, because there's so many homes and it's dispersed. I mean, that's really the key with the fire-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you see these images of these forest fires that have burned, you know, New Mexico or Colorado or California,
mm-hmm.
and the whole neighborhood's wiped out and there's one house.
Right.
And they say, oh, it's the miracle house. Well, no, it was just the house that didn't have fuels adjacent to it.
Right.
Right? If there's no fuels within 33 feet of your house, you can run a, you know, crown fire right over the top of it, and it, you know, will most likely survive.
Yeah.
So, you know, we put roofs on our homes to prevent the rain from falling inside. We insulate to keep them warm in the winter and prevent the foundations from cracking. Well, now we need to start building them to withstand fire, because fire is a weather event. It cannot be suppressed.
And as you mentioned, with the amount of fuel, you know, due to that loss of the canopy from the old growth, there's so much fuel that it's almost inevitable that there will be larger fire events.
Right. Almost 100 times more fuel on the landscape than before white incursion. And it's spruce and the balsam firs, not just down trees, but it's the standing trees that are maybe, you know, 15 to 20 feet high that are crowded in around under the older trees above them. And they, you know, serve as ladder fuels and carry those flames up to the crowns. And of course, once you get to the crown where the winds are more intense, then things can just start ripping. But, you know, I saw when I was doing research for the book, I went to the Interagency Fire Center in Idaho, and they showed me some experiments where they would open up the forest. There was a jack pine forest in Canada where they did these experiments. And they opened up the forest to about 30% crown opening, 35%. So they just removed the trees so that the tops of the trees had some space between them. Mm-hmm. So when you looked up at the sky through a tube, about 30% of the space in the tube was sky, not tree.
Sure.
And then, you know, started a crowd fire, and it ripped across the landscape, and it got to where this treatment was done, and it just fell down to the ground and started to kind of go out.
Wow.
But even that, you know, just that kind of thinning. But the clear cut won't get us there.
Right.
And the thinning is expensive. It's why they do the clear cuts, because the, you know, and wood fiber at the mill is pretty cheap. I mean, it's very expensive now at the lumber yard, but when it arrives at the mill, it's very cheap. So the economics of it are poor. And then, you know, of course, kind of doing thinning or prescribed burns or anything like that in the boundary waters is a difficult lift with the way the laws are written.
It's a very complicated situation, but it is very illuminating to understand the history of the forests here in this region, that it wasn't something that has just always been here in its current form, that it has been managed through human intervention for centuries.
Right. Well, and then the forests obviously are connected to the lake. If you want to manage water, you got to manage land. And so, you know, this suggests impacts to the water and the fisheries and so forth. Things like aquatic invasive species, particularly what I'm concerned about would be starry stonewort.
Yep.
It's in 16 lakes in Minnesota, but it's an invasive algae. And if a lake comes to be dominated by algae, right, which grows when the water is warmer, and starry stonewort is triggered, its growth response is triggered at the same water temperature as panfish spawning, and it loves panfish spawning beds, you know, it can just start to rip, and then it shades out the aquatic plants below it, and you come to have an algae-dominated lake rather than a aquatic plant-dominated lake.
And that's such a sad thing to see. We do see that on some lakes in Minnesota, and it would be a tragedy, I think, to see that start to spread into the boundary waters.
Well, you know, and so, okay, climate change is kind of going to happen, and to some degree or another, and those impacts are going to be very difficult for those of us who love the boundary waters to, you know, make a huge impact on. But AIS, aquatic invasive species, that's moved by people.
Mm-hmm.
So if people come into the boundary waters, check their equipment and make sure that everything is clean, and really put that on their to-do list before they go into the wilderness. You know, I mean, everybody's considering, you know, the gear, what kind of landing net should they have, lures, all this stuff. We put all this thought into, you know, our paddles even. A little bit of thought for making sure that everything is clean, and that when we're portaging from one lake to the next, we're not carrying any water with us. You know, we're not dumping our bait into the lake. We're making sure that the spiny water fleas that are caught on our downriggers or our fishing line or our anchor line, things that move through the water like that are cleaned. And I think a lot of places up there are offering these special towels that are really good at snagging that stuff and getting it off.
Mm-hmm.
That's something we can do something about, you know? And so that's kind of hopeful. You know, here's where we can act. We can stop the spread of aquatic invasive species into the boundary waters. And so far, you know, northeastern Minnesota really is an area of the state that has relatively few AIS compared to the rest of the state. That's a good thing, you know?
That's great. Well, I think that's a really good note to wrap up on, something that people can be aware of as they head out into the boundary waters and into the wilderness, to be aware of not transporting aquatic invasive species from one lake to the next, and just to be aware of that. Some little bit of awareness can help protect the things that we really value up here. Jeff, I want to thank you so much for taking your time today. As I said earlier, it's too short of a time. We've actually gone about double the length of time we had planned, but I would love to have more of a conversation with you. Maybe we'll have to do a podcast sometime down the road here, because I'd love to talk to you about a little more about writing, and in particular about Ken Kesey.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely get into those issues another time. I really appreciate your time. Jeff Forrester, thank you so much.
You bet, Brett. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and thank you for all you do for the area.
It's a pleasure. And this segment is brought to you by the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Coalition. The BWCAW Coalition is in partnership with federal, state, nonprofit, and business organizations to prevent the introduction of aquatic invasive species into the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. You're listening to the End of the Road Radio, WELY.